Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of the Scared to Dance podcast with me, your host, Paul Richards. Over the course of this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite people about their musical passions past and present. These include people who have DJed at our club night, as well as those who have created our film nights. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by John Grant, a singer, musician and songwriter whose work defies easy categorisation. From albums like The Queen of Denmark, Peregrine Ghosts and The Boy from Michigan, John's music has woven together deeply personal and confessional lyrics, with everything from beautiful balladry to synth pop catharsis. Hi, John, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for having me.
So you're in London at the moment performing at the Royal Opera House in an adaptation of Christopher Isherwood's A Single Man. How did that come about?
Well, the director and choreographer, Jonathan Watkins, sort of pursued me for like 5 years, giving me the book and saying I should read it. And I was really busy and I wasn't reading much at the time. And I didn't really understand what the vision was for it. And I didn't realize that it was a masterpiece until I read it and realized that it had been, you know, I don't know how I made it to the age of 57 without reading that book, truly, because it probably would have really helped me many, many times along the way. I sort of really appreciated the fact that he thought I was the guy for the job. And I mean, this took place over like 5 years, you know, so he kept coming back and saying, no, I really want to do this with you. So I had meetings with him and I really liked him. And then I realized that he had a lot of really interesting things to say, things that resonated with me. And so I felt like I had to try, you know, especially after I read the book. And then when I felt like I could trust Jonathan, which I did, then it became clear that I needed to do it.
Had you read any other Christopher Isherwood books? I'm a really big fan of Mr. Norris Changes Trains.
Yeah.
That's a great book.
No, I'm not very well read, I have to say.
And Goodbye to Berlin as well, which was the inspiration for Cabaret.
Yeah. No, I will now that I've read this incredible masterpiece, which is called A Single Man. I've become sort of evangelical about the book. You know, it's just so beautiful. But no, I'm not, you know, a lot of people think I'm super well read. I'm not really at all. I've read a lot of good books, but I read, you know, a lot of books when I lived in Germany, but I was, I'd say, better educated in German literature than I was in English language literature. And still there, I'm not very well read either. So, but I do love to read. I love to read a good book. I love, you know, The Painted Bird was my favorite book for a long time by Jerzy Kaczynski. And I really loved Immortality by Milan Kundera. So, I mean, I do some reading. But I mean, since the dawn of the internet, it's become, I think I have a attention deficit disorder of some sort. And I found it really hard to read for a long time, but Single Man really got me back into it. Because I think part of the reason is when you're reading a really good book, you know, it's no problem reading it at all, you know?
So what were your feelings when the director was pursuing you? Were you like, great idea, but I'm not so sure about being in a ballet, or were you apprehensive?
I wasn't apprehensive about ballet. I was apprehensive about, could I do the material justice? And, you know, what about writing for something else, you know, and could I do it in the time frame they wanted me to? And, you know, they wanted me to be on stage during the whole production as well, you know, performing. I didn't know if I wanted to do that either.
Had you written for anyone else before?
Not really. I mean, I've written songs for other people, but I haven't, but not that they've actually used. So, you know, I just thought, you know, I'm not very good at that. And I didn't know if I would be good at this, but I was so inspired by the material that it was really quite effortless.
Mm. So how did you come to craft those songs?
I just read the book and then we had several Zoom meetings, or maybe not several, but we had a few Zoom meetings about the themes that we were going to explore in the piece, you know. I mean, it was pretty straightforward. I mean, we all agreed, you know, Jasmine Kent Rogeman was doing the score for the piece. So everything between the songs.
Mm.
And we all just, you know, it was pretty easy to come up. It was pretty obvious what the themes were in the book. And then they just sort of, you know, Jonathan just sort of put it all together. And I just went and sat down and started writing about these different themes.
How did you find working with Jasmine? Was it, did you work it separately or did you collaborate at all?
We did it totally separately. Yeah. I had my stuff done first because I had tours coming up and there was no space for me to do it later. So I had to do it in January and February of this year. And I didn't know whether I could come up with 7 or 8 songs. I mean, obviously I could come up with 7 or 8 songs in 2 months' time, but whether I could come up with, you know, really good songs, you know, for a piece at the Royal Opera House in London, you know? But yeah, it just sort of flowed out of me. I mean, used the book as inspiration, you know.
How is it working to a deadline like that?
Well, I don't like it, but I think it's very good for me as well.
Yeah.
At the same time.
Do you have that with your albums? Do you use self-imposed deadlines or?
I allow deadlines to be imposed upon me sometimes to the detriment of the album and sometimes not so. It's a love-hate relationship, deadlines. You can't just go on forever. You got to do it. You got to finish it. So that's very good for me because I think without them, without deadlines, I'd never really finish anything.
Is there any examples you could give of the good and the bad working with deadlines?
Well, the album Grey Tickle's Black Pressure was a very, very rigid deadlines and very short periods of time. And I didn't like that. I didn't like working that quickly. I would have liked to have had more time. But I wasn't really paying attention, and there were people in my organization, if you will, who were imposing deadlines. And, you know, I mean, the first show at the Hammersmith Apollo was booked before I even went into the studio.
Oh, wow.
To do the album.
Was this the idea being Momentum?
Yeah. That's the word always, that's always used. Yeah. And that makes you want to, that makes you want to blow your brains out. Because,
I'm not sure what good art has come from.
Yeah. Fuck Momentum.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something to be said about it. I mean, when you're making a living, but when it comes to art, it's irrelevant. You have to take the time that it takes to.
Well, I think that's the music industry churning things out rather than.
Yeah.
This is ready. The artist is happy with it.
You got to break out of that circuit if you're in it, because it's being on that merry-go-round of that, you know, that cycle, that album cycle, you know, studio, write songs, album cycle. You don't have you're not really taking part in life.
Yeah.
In that vicious circle deal. So, and it is a vicious circle. So I'm sort of somewhere between the two, you know. I do take my time and say, you know, I'm not ready to do, you know, I need to think, I need to go experience, I need to think about, you know, what I want to say, do I have anything to say?
What do you do when that isn't there? How do you switch off?
Well, I don't have to switch off, it just happens naturally, you know, I mean, if I don't have anything to say, then nothing will come. I mean, you can always think of something to say, but it's, you know, the question, does it, I mean, there's all sorts of different types of music you can make too. So you can always come up with something, of course. You know, whether it fits into what you want to do, that's a whole different ball of wax, you know.
So what do you do with that? Do you just put it in a drawer somewhere and think, hey, that could be good for this kind of sound?
Well, I mean, luckily, I sort of am all over the place, all over over the course of any given album.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's different styles of music. And I think that's great because I feel like that's what everyday life is like.
Mm.
When you go out into the world, you get all these different things. So that's what the experience of a human is actually like. You don't really get this cohesive, you know, the Mazzy Star experience or, you know, that type of vibe when you go out into the world. And I suppose sort of what I like doing is sort of, or at least that's what I tell myself. That's what I've convinced myself, that I like the representing the what it's like in the everyday for a human, for, you know, in this case, this particular human.
Yeah.
That seems to be my thing, if I have a thing. But I just have so many different interests. I've never been interested in, I sort of feel like it limits me to say, oh, well, this is going to have to be this sort of album because this song sounds like this.
Yeah.
I don't feel like that. And I feel like my fans and people that are interested in what I do, they seem to be okay with that.
So how has performing in the ballet been compared to your normal life?
I mean, it is very different. You know, there's a lot of people involved. There's all these dancers, and then there's the musicians, the band, the quintet. But it's been an absolute joy working with everybody. I mean, the people are amazing across the board. I don't know. It's just been sort of transformative for me. I mean, I'm sure I'll just go back into my little world. You know, I'll fall back into my little world after it's over. But at least I've been given a glimpse of what things can be like when you take part in community and you have, you know, you have all this, when you take part in the world, you know.
Yeah.
I really need that, and I deny myself that a lot of the time.
Why do you think that is?
Well, just because the way I've experienced life, you know.
Yeah.
I won't bore you to tears by telling you why exactly that is, unless you insist. But, you know, I mean, I don't trust community. I don't trust the world. You know, I don't feel comfortable in it. So, you know, I shy away from it. I spend a lot of time on my own, and I love being on my own. But I have to watch that too, because that's, you know, too much time on my own is no good either for me. I get too much in my head, and nobody needs that. But being, you know, running around London, being in London, it's a wonderful experience. I mean, I'm in Covent Garden, so Holborn and Covent Garden, you know, it's a really beautiful place to be in. It's lovely to walk around, and the people are fantastic, and the experience is great. It's, like you said, it's a whole different type of experience, but I feel very comfortable in it, you know?
So is this something you'd like to do again? I mean, not necessarily a ballet, but...
I don't know. I mean, it would depend on the thing. This was a perfect storm of good people, good ideas, inspirational material, all of that stuff. And that's not a given that you're going to get that, yeah. You know?
Had you seen the Tom Ford film version of Single Man?
Yeah.
It's great.
It is great. I loved it. It's a beautiful film.
Yeah. I remember seeing it when it came out, and I hadn't read the novel at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I'd read
Yeah, neither had
works.
I. Yeah.
But yeah, beautifully directed. I think it was his first film as well.
Yeah, it was impressive.
Yeah.
I thought, wow, that's very impressive.
Yeah.
For a first-time director, and I thought he was just some fashion dude, you know?
Yeah.
But he's obviously a man of many talents. And I like Nocturnal Animals as well.
Yeah.
That was another great one from him. So he seems to really have a knack for it.
Well, speaking of films, you created one of our film nights last year at Picture House.
Yeah.
And you chose Wim Wenders' Wings of Desire.
Yes.
What made you choose that?
Well, it's been one of two favorite films. I mean, it's sort of ridiculous to have favorite films, but I've always loved saying this is my favorite film, or this is my favorite song, or this is my favorite whatever, you know. I say that stuff all the time, and I have many favorites.
Yeah.
But Wings of Desire is, you know, that movie just sort of changed my life, you know.
It's achingly beautiful.
It's achingly beautiful, that film. I mean, it deals with, you know, the true everyday of the human experience, which I love. And, you know, all these different aspects and, you know, across the board, once again, this great cross-section of human experience.
Yeah.
Is the phrase I was looking for. And so I love that about it, but it's filmed mostly in black and white. And I don't know if it was the cinematographer, but the fellow that did the lighting for Jean Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast.
Oh,
as
really?
Well. We talked about that. His name is Henri Alécan.
Okay.
Alécan. I don't know how it's pronounced. Just masterful, the lighting in that movie and the beauty of the black and white. Incidentally, The Painted Bird has just come out.
Oh.
In the last couple of years,
yeah,
finally the film version of that,
yeah,
and it was worth waiting, you know, 30 years for, because I was loving that. I was, you know, all worked up into a froth over that book in the 80s, you know. And speaking of beautiful black and white pictures, I mean, Ripley on Netflix was an incredible masterclass in black and white,
yeah,
cinematography. Black and white photography, cinematography, and The Painted Bird is also another one. So all of you out there in TV land or wherever the hell you are, you should check those films out because they're, if you want to see dazzling beauty. But, you know, Wings of Desire, and then the storyline, the angel.
Fallen angel.
The fallen angel comes to Earth. Or these two angels, they're not necessarily fallen angels, but they've come to observe.
Mm.
They're observing humans. And one of them falls in love with a girl and a woman in a circus. And there's, I think it's, I always get all these names wrong, but I think it's Laurent Petitgrand that does the music for the circus music,
mm-hmm.
I believe. It's just so beautiful. That score has so many incredible, I mean, there's Nick Cave, there's Crime in the City Solution, there's Laurie Anderson, and there's this unbelievable score by Jürgen Knieper, which is, besides Blade Runner, my favorite score, you know?
Yeah, also a big fan of Blade Runner.
Yeah, it's just absolutely stunning, the whole thing. And then you have the Lied vom Kindsein, read by Bruno Ganz, who unfortunately, well, passed away not too long ago in the last 5-10 years, as well as Otto Sander. Both of the angels are now left Earth. But yeah, so he decides to give up his wings. Bruno Ganz, the one that plays the, can't remember what his name is in the movie, and come to Earth as a human.
I think there's something about Bruno Ganz's eyes in that film.
Oh.
He's got these eyes that just suck you in. Mm. There's so much emotion in them.
Mm-hmm. Incredible actor.
Yeah.
And
Damiel,
of course. I mean, I've known that and forgotten that many times. But I saw that in the theater when it came out in 1988 in the most beautiful little art house cinema in Denver, which recently closed, which absolutely breaks my heart. It was one of the most beautiful places on earth and continues to be for me.
Mm.
It was called the Esquire Theater.
Yeah.
And it was playing there in 1988. And I went and sat there by myself and watched this film. And it just, I was so grateful for it that this existed. You know, it just transformed me on the inside. Not enough, but.
And had you seen any other Wim Wenders films at the time? I think when we did the Q&A, you said you hadn't seen Paris, Texas.
Yeah, I still haven't watched Paris, Texas.
I'm astonished, John, you've not seen Paris, Texas.
Well, I've owned it for many years, and for some reason I think I seem to be saving it for something, because of course I've known that, you know, I've heard, you know, friends talk about it being their one of their favorite films.
Yeah.
I've heard people talking about it ever since, you know, Wings of Desire came out.
Mm.
But for some reason I've been saving it for myself, and I'm excited, you know, because I love Harry Dean Stanton and Harry Dean Stanton and Nastassja Kinski is an incredible actor, and I just love her too, from One from the Heart and Cat People and Tess, and you know, she's amazing too. So I know I need to get on it, but I haven't seen Alice in the City either. Alice in the City,
yeah, or, also great. So I think it's slightly earlier, Alice in the City's my memory.
I'm planning on getting the Wim Wenders box from Criterion. I want to get that.
Yeah.
And go deeper. But I mean, you know, Wings of Desire just stopped me in my tracks. You know, it was like, this is all I need to exist, this film. Sort of how I felt about it.
Well, Wenders described making it as a desire to rediscover Germany in his heart. It was a quote that I was reading when we were doing the film Q&A. You lived in Berlin for a while, didn't you?
I was mostly just staying with a friend there and coming back and forth. I was on tour all the time. So it was sort of my center for a while. This would have been like 2010, 2011.
How was Berlin for you?
I mean, it was quite dark for me. It was much darker than I wanted it to be for me because of what's inside of me, because of what it brings out in me. But I love it. I mean, I mean, it's one of my favorite places in the world. There's nothing like it, of course. It's so beautiful. Yeah, that's all I can really say about it. It was quite dark for me. I suppose I was there before I got HIV, and I didn't get HIV in Berlin, but, you know, it's a very sexually open city. You know, you can really get your sex on in Berlin. You know, you can do anything there that you want.
Yeah.
And you can do it 24/7, basically. And that was quite seductive for me at the time, not necessarily in a good way, sort of in a destructive way. Because, you know, I can take anything and use it against myself, you know?
Okay.
Whether it's drink or drugs or sex or food or money, anything. You know, it seems to be used, for me, I use it as, in a self-destructive way because of, like I said, what's going on inside of me. So,
did you write any songs while you were there?
No.
No?
Not yet. I mean, that may happen still.
Mm.
I still want to spend some more time in Berlin.
Yeah.
I have great friends there, and yeah, I love the place. I just have to treat it with respect and,
yeah,
you know, have my wits about me when I'm there.
Well, we were talking a little bit before the podcast recording about how different cities give you different feelings, perhaps.
Yeah.
And I did the club in Berlin for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
Go there 2-4 times a year. For me, it's always been a place to visit rather than live, I think.
Yeah.
I think I share a lot of the same feelings as you do. And I absolutely adore Berlin.
Yeah. I mean, I felt very, very, very romantic about Berlin because I went there in 91.
Mm.
You know, I went to East Berlin, Prenzlauer Berg.
What time to be there?
You know, in 91 and 92. And yeah, it was an incredible time to be there. You know, I was listening to a lot of Cabaret Voltaire and Diamant de Galas, and that was a beautiful backdrop to Berlin. Of course, I had Wings of Desire in my head, you know, being there, of course. And
what took you there in 1991?
I was, I went with a friend.
Yep.
Yeah. And we just stayed with friends of hers in, you know, in these beautiful pre-war apartments, you know, that are with the high ceilings, and everything was dirt cheap. And there were these incredible cafes popping up all over the place, and music was, you know, I was listening to all this beautiful music. And so I had very romantic ideas about it. But when I went back, you know, 20 years later, it was quite different.
Yeah. And how's living in Reykjavik now? You've been there for quite a while, haven't you?
I've been there for 14 years now, yeah.
Yeah.
I lived in Germany for 6 years, you know, from 88 to 94, and then moved back to the States. So I'd spent a lot of time there. And now I've been, you know, over double the time in Reykjavik. And I still can't speak Icelandic the way that I spoke German, because it's much harder. And of course, I'm not just a student who's sole objective is to learn the language. You know, yeah. I'm gone all the time and living out in the world, but I am deep into Icelandic and, you know, getting there, but much more slowly. It's just a whole different ball game at the age of 19 than it is at the age of 50. Well, geez, I was in my late 40s. I can't believe I was only 42, 43.
Yeah.
When I moved there. Now I'm 57. Which is a weird number for me because my mom died when she was 57. And that just gives you pause. It makes you think.
Yeah.
You know, I thought she was old, you know, when she was 57. Now I'm 57 and I realize she was so young and had so much of her life ahead of her. And I get why I understand now why it was so horrifying for her, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Or, I mean, yeah. Anyway, but I digress. Where were we?
Jürgen Nieper with Wings of Desire, he wanted to write angel music for the score.
Mm.
Has writing for films ever appealed to you? Have you ever been asked?
I haven't been asked.
That kind of surprises me.
It surprises me too, because my music is very cinematic.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm making little movies is what I'm doing, I think, with songs. That's what I think I'm doing in my head. And so, yeah, I am very open to doing it. I'm not too worried about it, whether I'm going to be asked to do it or not, or whether it's actually going to happen, because I'm happy to keep making my albums.
Mm.
But I think I should do it. I'm not sure if I'll like the process.
Deadlines.
Well, deadlines and other people involved, and you know, I'm sure there's the quota of killing your darlings is much higher in that.
Yeah.
And people come in at the last minute and say, no, that doesn't work. Do this, do something else. Or, you know, so, but yeah, I am intrigued by it and would like to do it.
Yeah.
In spite of myself, I'm pretty sure I would like to do it. I'd like to do a horror film.
Yeah. That'd be great.
Yeah. Because I think that, I mean, there's great, great examples of great scores for horror pictures. Like, you know, Colin Stetson for Hereditary, and I think The Exorcist has one of my favorite scores as well, and that was largely done. He couldn't really find anybody to do what he wanted to do, so he and someone else William Friedkin, together with somebody else, they made their own score for it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so William Friedkin did it together with like an engineer and musician. I'm not sure what the story is on that, but it's interesting. You can look it up on YouTube and see a documentary that has a lot of info about how they did that score.
Mm.
But it was very, you know, like I said, he couldn't find what they want, so they did it, you know, they did it themselves. And it's so effective. You know, I think, and then like we talked about Blade Runner. So the, you know, the mixture of like The Exorcist and Blade Runner, those are the things that are, as far as scores go, that are part of, inside of me in my DNA.
Yeah. Well, speaking of documentaries, have you seen the Devo documentary yet?
I haven't watched the Devo documentary yet. I feel like it's going to be a really emotional thing for me.
Yeah. So when you DJed at the club early this year, and I was peering over your shoulder to see what was on your playlist.
Yeah.
There was a big old list of Devo songs. And I turned to you and said, oh, I didn't know you were such a big fan.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan. I'm not a Devo expert, but I am, you know, I have all of their stuff. And, you know, I collect vinyl and, you know, I have a lot of, you know, Hardcore 1 and 2 and all the stuff that's been coming out in recent years. And
so what kind of age did you get into Devo?
Records. Early 80s.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah, like New Traditionalists. Well, it was actually Freedom of Choice. That was one of the first videos I ever saw. That was one of the first videos played on MTV when it first started.
Well, they were a big MTV band because they had the videos already. And then, you know, music television comes along.
Right.
And they're looking for content. And you go, well, hey, we've already made loads.
Yeah. I mean, Love Without Anger is still one of my all-time favorite videos.
Yeah.
You must, everyone out there who's listening, you must immediately watch the Love Without Anger video. And you will feel a little creeped out, but you will smile a lot.
And we were talking about Whip It as well.
Yeah, Whip It. That's a great video as well. And that album, Freedom of Choice, New Traditionalists, Oh No, It's Devo. I mean, those albums changed my life. I sort of feel like Devo is like survival. Devo is survival for me. But I suppose any of the music that I was listening to was survival for me. I mean, Missing Persons during that time. We all loved Rio by Duran Duran too. And The Chauffeur. In particular, Save a Prayer. I mean, Eurythmics. I remember listening to I've Got an Angel. Me and my friend used to sit in his car and listen to I've Got an Angel on his, he had a booming system, and there was this incredible drum machine on I've Got an Angel from Eurythmics. And we'd listen to Devo and Dead or Alive, and that was... I was really into Blancmange and Visage, and New Order was huge, and all the 4AD bands, you know, Dead Can Dance and Cocteau Twins were, you know, that's, but this was early 80s. This was before I got into all of that, you know what I'm saying? I wasn't listening to Susie and the Banshees while I was listening to Devo.
Yet, yeah.
You know, it was Devo, 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 Devo all day long. And luckily, I'll never recover from that. I don't want to. You know, it was... Truly, Explosions is probably my favorite Devo track, but there are so many incredible ones. I mean, Jerking Back and Forth, Through Being Cool, Going Under, Snowball, Girl You Want.
Girl You Want, I play at the club a lot.
Yeah, and God, there's one that I really love off that album that I keep forgetting the name of. Where is that? If That's Good is amazing. I mean, I remember when that came out, my mom was going somewhere, getting something from some fabric store or a craft store or a hardware store or something. I was sitting in the car and that came on the radio.
Yeah.
And that was a hit, you know, That's Good was, I don't know what kind of a hit it was, but it was played on the radio a lot when Oh No, It's Devo came out. But yeah, I was there for when, you know, New Traditionalists came out. Well, it was Freedom of Choice, New Traditionalists, and Oh No, It's Devo. That was my Devo experience. And of course, the two albums before that are, you know, I mean, that is essential Devo. Another favorite from Are We Not Men, We Are Devo, is Sloppy.
Yeah.
I Saw My Baby Gettin', which is one of the greatest songs ever made, in my humble opinion.
I mean, that was my entry point into Devo, was the first album.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a huge fan of Brian Eno, and he produced it, or I should say probably loosely produced it.
At County Planks, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in the documentary, I didn't know this, that David Bowie was supposed to produce that album.
I believe I heard that.
Yeah, he saw them play live in New York.
Yes.
And was like, I need to produce these guys.
Yeah.
And then he was just on tour constantly, and they were just like, well, when are we going to do this?
Yeah.
And eventually he was like, oh, I haven't got time to do this. Get Brian Eno to do it. So Brian Eno comes in, and Devo are such control freaks that he just can't change anything on the album. Like, he'll change something and they'll come back into the studio and put it back. So eventually he just sort of gives up and just goes, okay, fine.
Yeah.
It's going out like that.
I'm sort of that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I give myself a lot of shit for maybe, you know, saying out loud sometimes that I don't know what I'm doing, but I sort of do, you know.
So I do
know what I want.
So what's your relationship like with producers?
Well, they learn quickly that I have a lot of opinions.
Yeah.
And that my actions when it comes to music or the things that I love in a song are very deliberate, and that I don't want those things changed. And that when I say I want a lot of bass, that I want the bass to be fat.
Yeah.
It has to be, you know, I want the bass to sound like it does right here.
Yeah.
In this spot. I want it to be that fat when you're listening to it everywhere else, you know. I think people find it quite frustrating sometimes because, you know, there's certain things maybe I don't understand about how, well, I still don't feel like I don't understand it. You know, I feel like I do understand it, you know. It can be done.
So how do you go about choosing the right producer for?
I mean, it's usually just, you know, I've usually done it with people that I know.
Yeah.
You know? Except, you know, I didn't know John Congleton very well when I did that album with him. But, and he made a lot of the decisions on that record. I would have wanted to be more involved. That was a difficult record for me, but, you know, he and I got along. You know, he is an incredible dude. So we got along personally really very well. But I didn't always like that process.
Why was it a difficult album for you?
Because I had to do it in such a short time frame, and he was making a lot of decisions. You know, he was just sort of, you know, he takes a very hands-on approach. Mm. So I didn't have the power that I usually have. And I mean, that's good too, you know. But, you know, for who I am, I don't like that. I'm not saying it wasn't good for the record. I'm saying that because of who I am, I didn't particularly like that. But I liked him.
And in terms of working with other people, you've collaborated with an amazing list of people: Sinead O'Connor, Kylie Minogue, C-Matt, Midlake, Tracy Thorn. I could go on. How do they generally come about? You get approached, or have you ever approached other people?
Kylie's people approached me saying that she'd love to sing with me at Royal Albert Hall.
How was that for you?
Amazing.
Yeah.
She's great.
Yeah.
I really dig her. She's a pro, you know, and she's fun.
Yeah.
And very cool and very laid back and chill. And that was quite an experience, bringing her out on stage and watching, you know, everybody lose it.
Proper pop star.
Yeah.
And C Matt's just taking off.
She approached
this year.
Yeah.
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 It's a great track.
Yeah. That's an amazing track. And, you know, I didn't know whether I wanted to work with her, but I knew that I liked her voice and I liked what she was doing. She's very good. And so I was definitely open to it. Then I heard the song. I finally listened to it. And, you know, I was like, wow, this is great. I'm doing it, you know.
And what about Sinead O'Connor? I mean, that's icon status.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she sings on one of my favorite John Grant songs. It doesn't matter to him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she sings on a lot of the songs on that record. And that was incredible. I mean, she covered Queen of Denmark, and that's how I got a chance to meet her.
Right.
She covered that on her album, How About I Be Me and You Be You, or something like that. And then we got to meet, and we became friends. And then she said, you know, if you want me to do anything on anything else, just let me know. And I was like, yeah, every song, you know. So that was incredible. I mean, she's talk about pros, you know, she was incredible. She and her daughter, Roisin, sang with me on Greatest Motherfucker. That was incredible. Yeah, I mean, I didn't feel deserving of that, but I didn't care. You know, it was incredible.
Is there anyone that you'd like to work with in the future?
I still want to sing with Elizabeth Frazier. She's my favorite singer. She's the best. But I also have a lot of, she's always been my top. Like the sweetness and the timbre of her voice is, there's just nothing else like it in the world. So that would be amazing. I mean, I'd love to sing with Kate Bush.
Yeah, I mean, Kate Bush, in fact, I can see a Kate Bush poster from my viewpoint here, and also from the same town that I'm from.
I suppose I have several favorite singers, you know, just like I have several favorites of anything else. But I think it was The Kick Inside and The Dreaming and Hounds of Love, you know, been on heavy rotation for...
Hounds of Love is astonishing. Weirdly, I've been listening to The Big Sky a lot lately.
Yeah.
It runs into Cloud Busting's in that little run as well.
Yeah.
And the first half of that is just astonishing. Just to open with Running Up That Hill.
I mean, it's just insane. I'm not sure when I got into Kate Bush. I think it might have been when Hounds of Love came out, and then I went back and The Dreaming The Night of the Swallow is one of my favorite tracks of all time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Period. Yeah, she has a lot of my favorite tracks of all time. So yeah, but I don't really feel anymore, that I have to, you know, if something like that were to, you know, happen, that would be great. But I don't really feel like it has to happen anymore. Like, you know, I think, oh, this, I need to do this. I have to do this. I don't really feel that way anymore.
Are you working on a new set of songs at the moment? Do you have any?
Yeah, I'm always doing that. I'm never not doing that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody's ever really turns it completely off. But I want to do the music from A Single Man as a record, you know.
Soundtrack album.
Yeah. I want to do that first.
Yeah.
And then I want to do my next record. And so it's definitely in the initial phases of taking shape in the bowels of my mind, in the convulsions of my mind.
Is there anywhere in particular you'd like to record? Anywhere, any particular studios, like different parts of the world?
I've never really thought about it. I always thought I'd like to go to Compass Point Studios because, you know, because Grace Jones and Thompson Twins and other people that I really loved, you know, played there or recorded there. Most famously, I suppose, Grace Jones, you know.
Yeah.
And that makes me feel very romantic about Compass Point. But I don't really know if that's, I don't know if I truly want that.
You've told me a Grace Jones story in the past.
Have I?
I'm trying to remember.
What, playing ping pong together?
That's right.
Perhaps? Yeah.
Yeah. How did that happen?
Well, I mean, my producer on the last record, he had a relationship with Grace, and he also produced Grace's Hurricane record.
Yeah.
And which is another favorite record of mine. I just couldn't believe how incredible that record was when it came out. You know, that it was just as important as Nightclubbing, you know, and just an incredible addition to her catalog, you know. Yeah, so I got to meet Grace because, you know, Ivor knows Grace really well. He's known her for ages, for yonks, as you say. So yeah, we went over to her place once, and she loves tennis and she loves to play ping pong. And she has one of those little miniature ping pong tables in her living room. It's hard to get used to those miniature tables. But yeah, we played and it was amazing. She's really good.
Who won?
I won't say that on live. I can't say that on live television.
You were playing festival dates this summer. How is that for you, playing festivals? Do you enjoy it?
I didn't used to, but now I'm quite into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I sort of, once you embrace the chaos of it, that's all right.
Yeah, I was talking to a few musicians about this, and I think everyone has quite different feelings towards it. I know some bring the greatest hits, and, you know, it's not your audience normally, unless you're headlining.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of winning the audience over.
Yeah.
Or do you play the new album? Or, you know.
Right. I mean, I always play the new album, except, and then I always put some of the greatest hits in there.
Yeah.
You know, But I really respect people like Low, for the band Low, for example, who would play, you know, whatever they wanted during their sets, you know, and if they wanted to do a drone set for 45 minutes or an hour or whatever, they would do that, and they have. And I really respect that, and I would love to be able to do that and just make sounds, you know, but I don't know if I could get away with it. Well, I suppose you can just do it. Mm. But, you know, whether you would be invited back, that's another question. You know? But yeah, it would be fun to me. I mean, I'm going to do an instrumental album next year with a friend of mine. We're just going to go and have fun and make beautiful sounds together.
Is that something you've wanted to do for a while, an instrumental album?
Yes.
Did he approach you or did...
No, I suggested it.
Oh, okay.
You know, and he was like, yeah, that's a great idea. There's going to be a lot going on next year. I'm sort of hoping to cocoon a little bit next year and be very creative and make a lot of music. You know?
Not so much live.
Well, I mean, that'll be there, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, I always want to do that. I don't want to get rusty or get out of practice. I'm going to keep my bedraggled larynx from, you know, falling into disrepair.
Your lyrics often feel very introspective. And we were talking about Christopher Isherwood earlier. Are there any writers that you find particularly inspiring? Where does the inspiration come for a John Grant song?
I mean, it can come from anywhere. It can come from, you know, a color or a phrase or a single word or a moment.
Do you jot things down on your phone?
I jot things down all day long.
Yeah.
All the time. And a lot of times what I do is I make a list of song titles.
Ah.
And then I build the songs around those. You know, titles that have to do with themes that I'm interested in, or moments or things that I've experienced, you know.
Yeah. So what's on your phone at the moment?
Oh, there's too much. I'm not going to read them out loud because I don't want to like spoil what's coming up. But there's a huge list of possible songs. So, I mean, I love to do that. I love to jot things down. And I take a shitload of photos. So it can come from a photo as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know whether I'm, I don't, there's so many stories to tell. And I have told other people's stories in my songs. But I usually go with, you know, what's inside of me, what I know, which I think is good, you know, maybe from an anthropological standpoint. You know, I mean, our existence is quite insignificant, and yet each one of us has a unique existence that is interesting, and people are interested in other people's experiences. So while I see my experience as totally irrelevant and insignificant in the bigger picture, obviously. You know, it's unlike any other. There is that, you know.
How do you feel like putting that much out into the world about yourself? Was there ever a point when, perhaps when you were younger, where you questioned if you wanted to do that or not? Or did you think maybe writing about other characters, a little bit of John Grant in there, would be the way forward?
No, I think I was always so unable to be who I was and say what I wanted to say that I felt like, well, now you're going to get it.
Okay.
You know, maybe it's a defense mechanism.
Yeah.
You know, like now I'm going to have my say. And I'm going to have my say. And a lot of people call that self-indulgent, but I don't think that's right. You know, I don't see that as particularly self-indulgent. Or maybe it is, and maybe that's not wrong when it comes to art. I mean, I think doing what you know is quite good when it comes to art.
And did that ever change from the Czars to your solo albums?
Yeah, I think I was trying to avoid certain topics in the Czars, and I didn't really feel comfortable doing it in the context of that band, you know. But yeah, I mean, I was really starting to make it, I suppose it was always about me, you know.
Do you ever miss being in a band?
No, because I have a band that I work with, you know, and but yeah, I suppose sometimes I do. I mean, there's not as much pressure on you.
Okay.
You know, there's more cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah.
But I mean, a lot of times you hate that too, you know, like I hated that. I didn't want that. You know, I wanted to do everything myself. But once you get to do everything yourself, you realize that it's hard. It's all on your shoulders as well. And there's a lot of things that I'm not good at. So, I mean, I always bring people in, you know, I can't do it on my own.
You know?
That's just the bottom line. You learn that quickly. But I hear people talking about, you know, that maybe the way I do lyrics or the way I do my thing is self-indulgent or selfish or something like that. And I don't, maybe that is true, but I don't, see myself being any, you know, different when it comes to my art.
And how do you look back on your studio albums? Do you ever have to revisit them?
Yeah, I have to revisit them sometimes, usually individually for, you know, tours. And maybe I'll do that later in life, but I always feel like I experienced that already and I don't really need to go back and listen to it. Although when Tim Burgess was doing his thing online during COVID.
The listening party.
You know, I had to listen to, I did that with him with Pale Green Ghosts and had to listen to that all the way through.
How did you feel?
I loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I was very happy with it. Thank you. Yeah. And I think for the most part, I am happy. There's times when I didn't feel like I'd really learned the songs yet and wasn't singing that well. And that gets on my nerves because I know once I get out there and I'm doing it and have really learned the songs, I'm really inhabiting those songs and really singing them the way that I should have been singing them. I'm not good at practicing songs while I'm writing them to sing them in the studio. I just do it, you know, and I'm not the greatest singer in the world. So I need time to really get into it, sort of. That's why I want to take a little bit more time, you know, doing it.
So
getting the performance right.
So are there any albums that, or songs that you've released that you look back and you think, well, that could have been better? Or
conversely, ones
that just think, well, I really knocked it out of the park there.
Yeah, I mean, disappointing. I felt disappointed in my my vocal performance on that. Yeah. But I mean, I'm a harsh critic of myself. I'm looking forward to playing disappointing again.
Well, how do you plan a set?
I always want Tempest in the set because it's my favorite. That's the one where I feel I knocked it out of the park.
Yep.
You know, I love that song so much. It just embodies what I wanted to do. It's just turned out exactly the way I wanted it to, you know?
Yeah.
And I love doing it live, but I don't get to do it live much. I wanted to do it. I'm working with an MD who doesn't feel like it really fits in the set. And I sort of disagree with him, but I really trust him as well. And so I'm just, you know, I'm allowing that to happen because he's really good at what he does. And I have experienced that firsthand. So I'm just letting him do it. But I make up the set list together with him. His name is Eddie Stevens, and he's really worth his salt.
Does it ever change from show to show? Or do you, when you start a tour, is it, that's the set? We're sticking with that.
Usually that's the set.
Yep.
Yeah. But I mean, I can sit there and play things by myself. Say if something that I wanted to do that's not on the set list, and I'll switch out some of the songs and play something else. So yeah, that does happen that it's different from, and I think that's very good. Sometimes when people request things that I didn't plan to play, and you know, if I feel like I can do it justice in that moment, you know, and then I will do that as well. And I feel like that kind of interaction is important as well in the live setting. Of course, that's what it's all about, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I really love doing these sets with Eddie. He's incredible. He really thinks about all the things that you must think about when it comes to the live setting, you know, thinking about flow, thinking about, you must think to some extent about what the audience wants and then incorporate that, you know, into your bigger picture, obviously, so that you're not just leaving them, you know, so it's not just every single song on your new album and they don't get to hear any of the things that they have come to love about your catalog, you know. So that's important. But he thinks about instrumentation and how the song should be done live and different ways of doing the song live, flow, you know, what's appropriate to do and at what point in the set, you know, there's ebb and flow during the set, you know, you build up to something and then you come back down and build back up again and there's the climax, and that's really important to me.
So the John Grant drone live experience may have to wait.
Yeah, maybe I'll have to do it under a different name and a costume or something like that. You know what I mean? Just so that I can get it out of my system.
That sounds great. Well, John, it's been great to see you again. Thanks for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you, Paul, for having me.
A huge thanks to my guest, John Grant, for such an open and honest conversation. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review. You can also follow us on social media at Scared to Dance for news about our upcoming events. Next week, I'll be joined by the singer-songwriter Billy Martin, who's released one of my favourite albums of 2025 with a brilliant Dog-Eared. I hope you can join us. This podcast was recorded and produced at Third Floor Recording.